At a million other choices, we discuss some dark and troubling topics. If dark and troubling is not your thing, mine might not be the right podcast for you. If you like your dark topics discussed without pesky ads and are looking for some additional content from me, you can sign up for the exclusive feed. The link should be in the show notes, and if not, you can find me on redcircle.com. I research each case myself, and I do my best to use a wide variety of sources, preferably directly from court documents when they're available, to ensure that the information is as accurate as possible. But I cannot verify the truth of all reporting that is publicly available. So this episode has been produced for information and entertainment purposes only and should be taken as such. And with all my legal and publicity stuff out of the way, let's listen to what words I will inadvertently mispronounce today. You know how I always say everyone you know is capable of murdering you? Well, today kind of highlights that, I think, that under the right circumstances, you can't really trust anyone not to murder you. This is the murder of Brittany Cargill. Brittany Cargill was born August 31st, 1996, to Mom Suzanne and Dad Everett in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And Saskatoon, for your FYI, is the largest city in the province of Saskatchewan, which you have to be Canadian to say five times fast, has a population of about 300,000. It is nicknamed the Paris of the Prairies. It's originally home to the Cree and Dakota First Nations people. It was settled by coloners in 1882. It's the prairies, picture fields of wheat, and then a city kind of in the middle of that. And although little is really known about her childhood, which appeared happy and vibrant, pretty typically Canadian, she was growing into a lively and adventurous young woman who was working hard at the Nutanta Collegiate to finish up her grade 12, and then planned on getting a degree in business management. And to fund her adventures, which included snowboarding, camping, boating, she also had a taste for some fashionable trends in clothing. She worked part-time at the German Cultural Center. She had flowing locks of auburn hair, a petite, slim build. She was definitely sure to be breaking some hearts in her wake as she grew into her own woman. And Brittany had just recently met her bio dad, Everett. She'd been separated from him for many years and was working on building a relationship with both him and her stepmom, Christy. Like her parents had split up when she was really, really young, and she hadn't really known her dad until recently. And he had remarried, giving her a stepsisters, Courtney, Tristan, and Victoria, which she was sort of working on building a bond with. Her parents and family described her as, quote, "Brittany was adventurous, independent, strong-willed, and always spoke her mind. She was beautiful, vibrant, and warm-hearted. She was really into fashion and wanted to start her own business one day." And then her friend, Atasha, said of her, "She had goals and was driven to get what she wanted. She wanted to build and own her hotel chains. I right away knew she would go places," end quote. And in March 2015, Brittany was 18. She was pretty much living the life of a normal 18-year-old young woman. She had briefly dropped out of high school, but she was convinced by her older friend, Atasha's story, who was 32. She had met her when they both worked at a store together, to go back, finish up school, which she was in the process of doing. And like a lot of 18-year-olds, she had a pretty big and broad group of friends, but she also had a ride or die bestie, Cheyenne Anthony, with whom she was completely inseparable. They did pretty much everything together. So if you knew Cheyenne, you knew Brittany, and vice versa. Now, to fully grasp this story, you have to kind of cast your memories back to when you were 18. You know, you're fresh out of high school. Maybe it's your freshman year of college. You don't have to picture your hair and those acid wash jeans that you were wearing that were way too tight. It's more about kind of the things that you did and the way you thought things through at the time. So it's the night of March 24th, 2015. So definitely there's no acid wash jeans and everyone has cell phones. But Cheyenne and Brittany are getting ready to go out to this house party to do a little bit of partying. Now, Brittany had earlier in the evening spoken to Atasha. And when she asked her, like, what are you guys doing tonight? She said she's going to cruise around, maybe go to a party that night. So they were doing what I would call pre-gaming. Like, they're having a couple of drinks while they listen to some music, do their hair, makeup, taking some selfies, all that good stuff. And the plan was that there was no real plan other than this house party, which would probably lead to, you know, maybe another house party or winding up at a pub or a club or something like that. The only plan was that they were going to consume some drinks. So there was really no set plan. And they took their final selfie, one of those ones where Cheyenne holds up the camera high up and then Brittany kind of cuddles in behind her. And that was around midnight, and then they headed off. And I believe that they were initially going to be taking Brittany's car. Now, hopefully they knew that they were going to be leaving it somewhere and that driving wasn't going to be a thing. I don't know that. I think it's probably just wishful thinking on my part. But they went to this party, and then as the night wound up, they wound up at a bar called The Colonial. It was a pub and grill place. And by this time, both Brittany and Cheyenne were pretty liquored up. Like, in fact, we would probably say they were both wasted, as we like to say in these parts. So Brittany starts talking to this guy after she asked him for a lighter, and then they started talking. And this was in the parking lot of The Colonial. It doesn't sound like they actually went into the bar because this was around 4 a.m. So the bar was likely closed. But anyways, I guess Brittany started kind of flirting with this guy. And then he got into the car with the two of them. And then Brittany dropped Cheyenne off at a place called The Lighthouse, at which she thinks was around 4:30 in the morning. And then Cheyenne kind of lost track of her, which, like, we can all say, like, at 18, there's no way I'm going to lose track of my wasted friend who's leaving with some random guy. But to be fair, at 18, I lost track of my wasted friends all the times. And sometimes I was the wasted friend. I always have this one example that I always tell. I've told to my daughter a number of times just how things can kind of go. So I was around 19. And I decided to go out with my friends. And yes, the plan was to pretty much get wasted. So I knew enough to drive my car to the college campus because the friends that I was going with lived in residence at the campus. So I'd leave my car there, stay over at their place. We'd all share a cab and it was all going to be a good thing. So I knew I wasn't going to be in any kind of shape to drive myself home. So that was sort of the only part of the plan. So at this bar we went to, I wind up meeting this guy. You know, he's wearing a tight pair of Wranglers, got blabbing and flirting with him. And when it's last call, he says, "Oh, let's share a cab." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, cool." Like, I didn't even think to tell my friends that I was leaving. They didn't think to ask me where I was going and who I was going to go with because they were also wasted. And of course, at that time, nobody had any cell phones. So the next thing I know, I'm walking into this house that I've never been to with this guy that I really didn't know, and saw that he lived with like seven other guys, and now I'm the only girl there. And it dawned on me only then that I had no car, no money, and I'm at this strange guy's place, and have kind of voluntarily come back to his place. So his expectations might have been something. Anyways, in this particular case, everything turned out good. I mean, this guy was a perfect gentleman. He let me sleep in his room and then he slept on the couch. None of his roommates ever even bothered me at all. But I always think about how differently that night could have gone for me and how my friends would have felt having lost track of me and me not telling them where I was going. So these things can happen. So they lost track of each other. That's all that I'm really saying about that. And that it was pretty late by this point. Like, it was around 4:30 in the morning. So Cheyenne figured that she'd left with this guy that she was talking to. She might have gone home, whatever. Now, she did Facebook her. She said, quote, "Where are you? Haven't heard from you. Hope you made it home safe." Now, Cheyenne herself didn't really have a set place to stay. She had been in the foster care system from the time she was about two until she turned 18. Her parents had some issues with addictions. And when you turn 18 in the foster care system, you're just kind of let out of the system. You're on your own. So it sounds like she kind of couch surfed a lot and then would often wind up staying at her uncle's place at the Lighthouse, which is described as an assisted living shelter. Now, I've heard of assisted living places and shelters, but never the two of them combined like that. But when I Google it, it appears to be a not-for-profit run by the church, which was actually just taken over by the Mustard Seed run out of here in Calgary in November of 2024. So it does sound like more of a shelter. Anyways, I rabbit hole. Later on that same morning, so it's about 6 a.m. now, so this is the 25th of March now, a man out walking his dog near the landfill that's on sort of the outskirts of town around this intersection of Valley Road and Cedar Villa Road came across the body of a young woman. Now, reports kind of vary on whether or not there were any signs of life from her, but regardless, the woman was deceased either at the scene or declared upon the arrival at the hospital. And the police weren't able to identify her. She didn't have any real ID on her at the time, but they believe she had been dropped off there sometime between 5:20 and 5:40 that morning, which was based on eyewitnesses in the area at the time that didn't see her before that. Like she was kind of left in the open, so she would have been easy to spot. Now, she did have some distinctive tattoos, and the police posted photos of them online to help identify her. She had two star-shaped tattoos on her left hand, and then there was a lion face on her shoulder. And very soon after, they got a call from Cheyenne, who had seen the photos and then called from a place called the Lighthouse. And Cheyenne said, like, I think that's my friend Brittany. So Cheyenne tells them what pieces she can kind of remember from the night before. Like, she remembers getting ready with her and then going to a bar called Manchester's, which is on the corner of 33rd Street and Idlewild Drive, and then over to this house party that was on Avenue I. And then around 4 a.m., they were in the parking lot of the Colonial Pub and Grill, which is on 8th Street. And she remembers Brittany asking this guy for a lighter, and then that they were talking for a bit and that he got into the car with them. She can't really describe him other than that he was white. And then Brittany drove her to this lighthouse and left with the guy, but she was driving. It was her car that she was driving. She had a white Chevy Cavalier. And then Cheyenne told them that she'd Facebooked her asking where she had, that she hadn't heard from her, but that she hadn't heard back from her. And she put her uncle on the phone, and he said that Cheyenne had arrived. It was around 4:30 in the morning at that time at the lighthouse. So that was the last time that she was seen. So meanwhile, the police are kind of just kind of gathering whatever clues they can. She had been found on, it was kind of a side of a road near her vehicle, which according to one report was parked kind of askew. There were marks on her neck consistent with strangulation. She was not wearing shoes, and near her was a black leather jacket, a woman's watch, and a black leather belt. And the belt was one of those ones that's, I don't know if it was necessarily genuine leather, but it was braided. So it had left these distinctive marks on Brittany's skin, which was determined to be the likely murder weapon. Her car was dusty, had some grass in the tires, like it had been kind of off-road at some point. And there were marks in the dust and the dirt that was on the vehicle that was consistent with this belt that they found had been scraping or rubbing against it, like there had been some kind of struggle around the car. The autopsy confirmed that ligature strangulation was her cause of death. So, of course, the manner of death was homicide. And they were also able to determine that she had not been sexually assaulted.
Look at the facts. Accept what happens and really hope for the best. Best outcome for the family and the friends. And just knowing that she's not suffering anymore and in a better place, I think is a good thing. And that she's probably in a better place than where this world is today. It's scary out there. Can't even go over to a house party, can't go out anywhere without something happening, especially in this city. In my eyes, the city's become a thug town, and you have to be very careful at what you do and where you go. And this is one lesson. Unfortunately, it's a hard lesson, but it's a lesson to show, like, tell the world, like, look, you really need to be careful out there. This could be anybody.
So the cops go to this Colonial Pub to see if they can find anything on the surveillance camera about this kind of mystery guy that they that Cheyenne said that they met up with, but they couldn't see Brittany's car pull in at any point from like midnight till 5 a.m. So they go back to Cheyenne and they say, like, are you sure it was the Colonial? And she says, yeah, no, definitely. I remember it was the Colonial. And they also track down some footage from this lighthouse, this place called the Lighthouse, to see if they can see if when Brittany dropped Cheyenne off that night, if there was someone in the car with her. But they never saw the car or Cheyenne arrive at the lighthouse at that night at all either. But again, like Brittany's saying, well, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I'm here. It's where I called you from. So I don't know what you want me to say. So, but there was kind of something about Cheyenne's story that just wasn't really adding up to them. Like, they understood that she was intoxicated and that she might have been like blackout drunk at some point and doesn't remember a lot about that night. But why does she remember some parts so vividly, like that it was the Colonial and that Brittany had asked this guy for a lighter, but then couldn't remember what he looked like, and that he got into the car with them, and then she remembers being dropped off, but like she just doesn't remember anything else. And also their phones got mixed up. So Cheyenne's phone was in Brittany's car. And then Cheyenne says she woke up with Brittany's phone. Now, Cheyenne was actually known to the police, not for anything violent, but for a number of like possession, DUI, and some other matters usually related to substance use. So the fact that she had gotten wasted that night wasn't really surprising to them. But what was surprising is that when they tried to interview her again about 2 months later, she wasn't particularly cooperative with them and basically told them to bugger off. Like, this is your best friend. I would think that you would want to do everything that you could to try to remember some more details or help with the investigation in any way. But they really had nothing to go on. Now, it would make sense that Cheyenne's fingerprints were in the car. And even the fact that their phones had gotten mixed up, I mean, that's just a drunken mistake, right? Cheyenne's phone that was in Brittany's car lined up with the night as she had laid out pretty much except for that Colonial. But it did ping at a McDonald's at 4:30 a.m. So in her intoxication, she might have mixed up the location because her memory was a little bit fuzzy. So they had really no choice but to just kind of leave the case alone until something kind of came out of the woodwork.
Brittany was a very great person. She loved life. She loved living it. She had such a kind heart. She gave everything she could to make other people happy. She did what she could do to make me happy. She wanted to finish school and open her own business and do everything she could to be successful. And then life was taken from her and she's no longer with us. But when I'm here, I can still feel her presence. And she, it's almost like she's telling me, Nikki, it's okay. I'll meet you again. We'll be together again. I'm in God's hands. I'm safe. And I just got to remember her for the person she was.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
And in the meantime, Cheyenne's life kind of continued to spiral. She racked up a few more charges. She fell a little bit deeper into this hole of substance abuse. Now, I don't think the police ever thought that Cheyenne was responsible for Brittany's death, but that she knew more about that night than she was saying to maybe cover for someone or something that had happened that night that she knew about. So 6 months after Brittany's death, Cheyenne had posted the selfie that her and Brittany had taken that night with the caption, "I miss you so much, Bert. I wish heaven had visiting hours so I could come see you, but I'm so glad you came and visited me in my dream last night. I'm blessed to have met you and have you be a part of my life. Still can't believe those last 2 days were going to be the last 2 days I got to be able to hug you, talk to you, and laugh with you. I will cherish and hold our good memories." So investigators had They tried to do some undercover work to find out, like, maybe what Cheyenne knew. But because of her lifestyle of the couch surfing and drinking, and by this time she had kind of taken up a bit of a meth habit, it wasn't actually easy to pin her down and do any kind of undercover work on her. But they did go back and they put a little bit of pressure on her uncle to see if he knew anything. And he did relent that Cheyenne had actually shown up a little bit later than 4:30 that morning. She was drunk. She was terrified because she said that Britt and her had wound up partying that night in this hotel room with these two guys. And then there had been an argument over cocaine. And when she had come out of the bathroom, Brittany was on the bed and she had marks on her neck and she wasn't moving. And then these guys had put a gun to her head, to Cheyenne's head, and told her that they, you know, she better not talk or she better not say anything. She has to basically help them cover it up or else like she would be dead herself. And to the investigators, this story actually makes a little bit more sense because that's what they felt, was that Cheyenne knew more. But Cheyenne's pretty hard to track down and she's still not talking. So they start poring over Brittany and Cheyenne's social media to see if they can, you know, find any connecting thread to the story or just anything that they can find. And so this time it's 2 years since she has passed away. And that's 2 years for the Gargoyle family. Like, they've got no answers about who killed their baby girl. And so when they're looking over Cheyenne's Facebook post, they come across, of course, the selfie that the girls took that night. And one of the officers says, "Oh my God, I can't believe we missed that." Like, they're in this picture, Cheyenne is wearing a braided black leather belt. So if you look at this selfie, it's kind of hard to see, but once you see it, you can't unsee it. So Cheyenne is holding the phone up at an angle like you do when you take a selfie. And so most of the photo is just the top part of the girls, but there just so happens that Cheyenne is wearing this belt and she's wearing it cinched high at the waist of the gray dress that she's wearing. So you can just kind of see the buckle and then a little bit of the braiding at the bottom of the photo. So they ran DNA tests on the belt, and it did come back that both Cheyenne and Brittany's DNA was on it, but that still didn't conclusively prove that Cheyenne had killed Brittany, but there was also no unknown male DNA on the belt, which did kind of narrow it down a little bit. And then this woman, she's an unidentified woman, she approached Christy and Everett, who is Brittany's dad and stepmom, and said, like, I hate to tell you this, but that night or early in the morning, Cheyenne had come to her house. She was drunk out of her mind. She was hysterical that she had gotten into an argument with her friend and had hit her and choked her. And now she like wasn't moving. And when this woman looked out the window into the driveway, she saw a white car with a young woman in the passenger seat, kind of slumped over. She did look pretty beat up, and thinks that that might have been Brittany. And she completely freaked out at the time, told Cheyenne, like, get the hell out. She didn't want to be involved in it. Take her to the hospital. Do whatever you got to do. And of course, Everett and Christy take this little bit of information to the police, and they go back to this woman, and she told them what had happened. She said that she had been so freaked out and terrified that she hadn't said anything to anyone before. But by this time, it's March of 2017, so it's 2 years later. Cheyenne was in jail at this time over threatening a security guard with a contaminated needle when she was confronted about some shoplifting. So she felt that the time had come to come forward with this story.
We're so grateful, and so thankful that the investigators that have been working on this for almost 2 years never gave up hope, because it was very hard for us at times to keep that hope up. Yeah, the details are not going to be pretty. I'm raising her 7-year-old sister, who has a lot of questions and doesn't understand, so that's difficult. Brittany was very happy, joyful. She loved her family. She has 4 younger sisters. She loved her friends. She spent as much time with them as she could. She was a wonderful person whose life was cut short.
Now, apparently Cheyenne had been using methamphetamines for about 2 months before Brittany's murder and had already begun spiraling, and then, of course, continued to spiral afterwards. So the police visited the now 21-year-old Cheyenne in jail, charged her with second-degree murder, and at the start of the preliminary trial, she pled guilty to manslaughter. She said that she didn't remember killing Brittany, but she's pretty sure she must have. So all the agreed statement of facts in this case says is that she remembers being in the parking lot of McDonald's with Brittany, and that Brittany had gotten upset over her, over something about her phone, and then grabbed it from her. And then that's kind of the last thing that she remembers. Her attorney, Lisa Watson, read a statement from Cheyenne saying, "I will never forgive myself. Nothing I say or do will ever bring her back. I'm very, very sorry. It shouldn't have ever happened." And then Lisa added for her that for the rest of her life, she's going to have to live with knowing that she killed her best friend, saying, quote, "She knows the family would like an explanation, a reason, but unfortunately she can't provide that," end quote.
Drug and alcohol use exploded. My client had some very deep-seated personal issues that she was not dealing with, and unfortunately, for whatever reason, we'll never know, they turned into a very tragic situation for all involved.
Now, during the victim impact statements, Everett basically said that his life has changed forever now, and that the next day he was supposed to help her fix something on her car, and that that would have been the last time that he would have been able to hug her. He is both angry and sad that his daughter's life was cut very short. And then her stepmom, Christy, said, "You were her friend. She trusted you. The night you two went out, you ended her life. Not only did you take away a daughter and a sister who were just getting to know, you took away the lifelong potential we had to have her in our lives. The chance for her father to get to be there for her daughter that he had already missed out on so much with." And then she added that she could have taken Britton to the hospital instead of leaving her there to die on the side of a road and then trying to cover it up. Brittany's aunt Jennifer looked directly at Cheyenne and said, "You robbed this world of somebody who had a special gift and would have helped a lot of people struggling in life. Brittany defended you and your friendship to her family. And what did you do for her? Most days we can't stop thinking about Brittany, what happened that night, what she must have felt fighting for her life," end quote. Now, for the sentencing, this is manslaughter now. So if you've been listening to me long enough, you know this stuff already. But here in Canada, regardless of what province or district the crime happens in, murder and manslaughter are treated pretty much the same. First degree murder is always an automatic life sentence. There's no parole for at least 25 years. Second degree is a life sentence with parole eligibility that can be anywhere from 10 years, which is usually the minimum, to 25 years. It's 7 years, I think, is the maximum if you're a youth. But manslaughter can be anything from, say, a suspended sentence to life. It just sort of depends on the circumstances. And remember, manslaughter just means that your actions led to the death of a person, but that there wasn't any intent for that to happen, which to me in this case, I think is factually incorrect. Because when you put your hands on someone's neck or say, take your belt off and pull it around someone's body, there's definitely intent. Like, you know what you are doing is going to lead to a person's death, but I'm not a lawyer. So the justice, or what this justice is what we call a judge here, has to weigh both aggravating factors and mitigating factors to determine a fair sentence for manslaughter. And so in this case, the aggravating factors were that this was, of course, her best friend. So she was in a position of trust. She had deliberately tried to mislead the police investigation, and she had 54 prior convictions on her record. But under her Gladue report, which is a pre-sentencing report for Indigenous persons, both her parents were residential school survivors. They'd had her when they were both very young. They both struggled with substance abuse, so she was put into this foster care system. And in the foster care system, she was sexually abused. Now, there were actually charges pending on that case at the time. And then her mom died of addiction when she was 15. And that had, of course, sent her spiraling into this meth addiction. And when she was released from foster care, she basically was left traumatized. She had no coping or even life skills. So in the end, Justice Marilyn Gray gave her a 7-year sentence and said, "Miss Antoni, I seriously hope that while you are in custody, you will take the time to address some of your personal issues, as painful as they may be. Honor your friend by becoming a positive, productive, law-abiding member of the community. You owe it to her to persevere."
Just outside Saskatoon Provincial Court here, we have just learned the sentence of a woman who pleaded guilty to causing the death of what court heard was one of her best friends. Brittany Gargle was 18 years old when her body was found just south of Saskatoon near Cedar Villa Estates back in March of 2015. And today, Cheyenne Rose Antoine pleaded guilty to manslaughter in connection to Gargle's death. And the sentence that she received was a joint submission sentence agreed upon by the Crown and defense, the judge accepting it, meaning that Antoine will serve a 7-year sentence for manslaughter. Now, she was originally charged with second-degree murder, but pleaded guilty to the lesser-included offense of manslaughter. And today we learned the facts surrounding this case that was quite mysterious for about 2 years. What she remembers is that they left a house party that night. They were heavily intoxicated. And Antoine says her last memory is of Gargle taking her phone. Cheyenne Antoine actually tried to mislead police in their investigation by saying that she was there that night, but that she had nothing to do with it, that she had left before anything had happened, and kind of tried to almost make it seem like she was looking for her friend as well through Facebook postings. As far as a motive, we just spoke to the defense lawyer who said that this is a case where we will never truly know what caused this woman to kill one of her closest friends, as she just does not remember it happening. However, she does take responsibility for her being the one responsible for this woman's death. At Saskatoon Provincial Court, I'm Bree McAdam with the Saskatoon Star Phoenix.
So how things work when you're serving a fixed sentence, which is what manslaughter is, opposed to, like, say, a life sentence, you get what's called a statutory release date, which is set about 2/3 into your actual sentence. So if you behave yourself, you usually get out on that date. And Cheyenne had been granted day parole in June of 2020, but that had been revoked about 3 or 4 months later when she overdosed. And she had used a laptop that she wasn't supposed to, and she was just generally belligerent about the whole thing. But a year later in 2021, she was granted day parole again because she had finished up an addiction program. But she went on what this called unlawfully at large. And so she was rearrested in March of 2022. Then she went on to punch a correctional officer when she wasn't allowed to shower when she wanted to. And the parole board noted that this was actually one of 15 serious institutional charges and 44 minor charges that she had incurred for disobeying institutional rules, being disrespectful, threatening and assaultive to staff and other inmates, refusing urinalysis, possession of contraband, and diverting medication. So what they said is that they were still going to give her statutory release date, but she had to go from incarceration directly into a residential treatment center and then live in a halfway house after that, where she would have conditions on her until her actual sentence was over. Now, a statutory release isn't the same as parole, but it does have conditions on it. Like, you know, we're letting you out early, we expect you to behave. It doesn't sound like she really did that, though, because she was back before this board in the spring of 2023 when she'd got into that a bit of a scuffle with the staff at the halfway house over not letting them into her room to do a room check. But at that time, the board said, "During your suspension, you were very engaged, making every effort to speak with CBRF staff and your parole officer to find a solution. You demonstrated a significant amount of motivation to understand how your actions were perceived as threatening and identify how you could have done things differently. It was concluded that there was a lot of misunderstanding and emotion throughout the entire incident, and you, your parole officer, and CBRF staff felt the situation had been rectified." And they noted that she had finished this program called Indigenous Women Offender High Intensity Program, which focuses on cultural healing. The CSC reports that you accept responsibility for your actions, are future-oriented, and see the benefits of living a violence and drug-free lifestyle. The board takes encouragement from the fact that you are increasingly identifying as a cycle breaker and recognize the need for healing. And none of that really matters anyways, because even if she continues to behave herself or not, doesn't matter, because her sentence, like her sentence is set to end on April 18th, 2025. So she's going to be back into the community then for sure. And I don't like to end these cases on a lectury note, but please, if you know someone in your life that is actively taking methamphetamines, and again, I do not mean Ritalin or Vyvanse, anything therapeutic. I'm talking about like crystal meth. They are dangerous. So please just be really careful sharing space with them. No matter how much you love them and remember them as loving and caring and wonderful people, this drug is a game changer. So please take steps to protect yourself. And if you yourself maybe dabble in methamphetamines, like, I'm not here to judge or lecture you, but please at the very least consider switching your drug of choice. And also, please, 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 please do not drink and drive. Cabs and Ubers and parking tickets, I know they're expensive, but just please don't do it. The cab fare is so worth it. Just don't do it. And with that, I'm going to be back again with another case next week. Thank you so much for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.